From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, why low-cost international airlines might be looking at Milwaukee to expand their U.S. footprint.
If you look at Milwaukee as very accessible to Chicago, it's easy to get there by bus or a train or even a short flight. That could be a strong selling point for Milwaukee.
Then the newest research on flow.
I focused on the adventure sport athletes because they have gotten better at hacking the state of flow than anybody else probably in the history of the world. So we can use them as case studies and apply this information across all domains of society.
Our wine contributor connects with some familiar faces at this year's premier event in Napa Valley. And we'll tour the Racine Art Museum and its world-class collection of ceramics. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. It was just a few years ago that General Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee was setting records each month for passenger traffic, and airlines were doing battle for market share here. But things have changed a great deal in these past couple of years, and while December numbers showed a modest increase in passengers using the Milwaukee airport, the overall trend has continued downward. But could that soon change? Stacey Vogel Davis reports in the Milwaukee Business Journal that General Mitchell might be a place for some airlines to expand their reach, not just in the Midwest, but in the United States. She talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about where the trends might go and what's been driving traffic down in recent years.
Passenger traffic really peaked in 2010, and it had been building for a couple of years before that. And that actually, you might look at those 2 years as kind of being the out of the ordinary ones. There was an airfare war going on at General Mitchell. You know, you had Frontier, which was formerly Midwest Airlines, competing with Southwest and AirTran. They all wanted control of the Mitchell Airport, and that was unsustainable. You know, the fares were getting low, and there were lots and lots of flights, more flights than Milwaukee could support. So that kind of ended in 2010. Frontier started cutting back. They're now down to 7 flights a day, so they're practically non-existent at Mitchell.
I did see they are adding a flight to Trenton, New Jersey.
Yeah, which is actually part of their expansion in New Jersey. And actually, there is a chance they could expand again because they have a new owner now, so you never know what's going to happen there. But then Southwest also took over AirTran, and as they merged, they eliminated some of their direct flights as well because AirTran had been operating a hub out of Milwaukee, and Southwest doesn't operate hubs. So that really caused a huge dent in flights and passenger traffic.
The departure of Midwest, then Frontier, happened a while ago. Why did the numbers continue to fall in 2013? Is that mainly as a result of some of the redundancies in AirTran and Southwest being eliminated?
Yeah, it's as those two airlines continue to merge. So, I mean, Southwest announced the merger a couple of years ago, but they're still enacting, and actually they don't expect to be finished at Mitchell until the end of this year, completely integrating their systems and coming under the one name, Southwest. So they're still continuing to cut some of these flights and integrate. It looks like the cuts, for the most part, have settled down. Southwest is now at an average of 40 to 45 flights a day, if you include the AirTran flights. And it looks like it's going to stay that way for the foreseeable future.
Well, and so along those lines, do analysts believe things have bottomed out here?
It looks like most of the cuts for now have ended. I talked to one analyst who said airlines are cutting flights nationwide. So if they start cutting in one city and they cut their service to Milwaukee, that could affect Milwaukee. There's also another merger going on.
I think that's the American and U.S. Air.
Yeah, American and U.S. Air are still combining. So that could affect Mitchell a little bit, but they combine for less than 10% of Mitchell's traffic, so it probably won't be a huge impact here. So it looks like most of the big swings have ended for now.
Now, there's been an effort to market Milwaukee as kind of a low-cost hub for the northern suburbs of Chicago. Is that strategy still being employed?
Absolutely. That's still a huge marketing strategy for Mitchell. You see it on most of their press releases. And they're also doing some, you know, advertising and direct marketing, trying to get those northern Chicago residents to skip O'Hare and come up to Mitchell.
Well, so that's the effort to get more passengers. What about the effort to get more airlines? The other intriguing idea you write about is the possibility that low-cost international airlines might look at expanding to Milwaukee as a way maybe to tap into Chicago. What are some of these carriers?
A couple that consultant Jay Sorensen mentioned to me are Ryanair, which is based in Ireland, and they're kind of known as the the ultra low cost carrier. I mean, I think they might charge you to use the bathroom on Ryanair.
There's
the
extra
cost for
seatbelts.
For just about everything, yeah. Norwegian Air Shuttle apparently is looking to expand in the U.S. And another one that I've heard thrown around is Iceland Air, which is looked at as a cheap way to get to Europe. You take a flight to Iceland and then you go on from there to mainland Europe.
Is this speculation at this point? I mean, is there any indication that Milwaukee might be courting airlines like those?
At this point, it is speculation. The airport is continually looking to add more flights. So, if, you know, when you talk to them, they say they've talked to, you know, everybody that they could possibly talk to. So, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they had talked to these airlines. But at this point, we haven't seen anything solid to indicate that the airlines are looking at coming to Milwaukee.
And, you know, I looked at the websites for some of these low-cost carriers, international carriers that do serve the United States. And it seems like a lot of them, I know Norwegian Air Shuttle flies into places like Oakland versus San Francisco, and Ryanair might be flying to – I mean, it seems like the parallel between those airlines flying to large markets but in other airports might work in the standpoint that these airlines might be looking for more traffic to come out of Chicago.
Exactly. And that's one of the points that Milwaukee folks think could bring them into Milwaukee is that they're flying into these kind of second-tier cities. Actually, I heard from a reader who mentioned that he flies Ryanair often to get to Europe, and he was surprised when he was traveling to Frankfurt that he landed and wasn't in the main Frankfurt airport. He was about an hour away and he had to take a bus. So that's really how they operate. And if you look at Milwaukee as very accessible to Chicago, you know, it's easy to get there by bus or a train or even a short flight. That could be a strong selling point for Milwaukee.
And Milwaukee does accommodate international flights at this point, right?
They do. All of their international flights right now are in the Western Hemisphere. So we've got Canada, Mexico, Jamaica, and the Dominican Republic. But, you know, it is an international airport.
As this discussion is taking place, the airport is in the market for a new director, correct?
Yeah, Barry Bateman is going to be retiring this spring, and he's been there for 30 years. So it's been a long time under Bateman's tenure, and he's seen a lot of changes. He saw the big up and now, you know, coming down a little bit. So, you know, this is an interesting time, and it could be a time to, you know, get someone new in there who might try some new strategies.
He also injected a lot of personality into the airport.
Yeah, I think if you know Barry, you kind of know his shtick.
Finally, there's been work done to try to raise the profile of the area around the Milwaukee airport, the gateway, if you will. Is that effort any further along than it's ever been?
You know, at this point, it looks more of like a marketing tool, you know, using the name, the gateway to Milwaukee. And you know, they do have a staff person and different organizations looking into it, but it hasn't. You know, we haven't seen any direct results of that effort yet.
I know there was a hotel in the area that actually was torn down in just the last year and replaced with parking.
Yeah, it's been replaced by they call it a high-end parking service for the airport. They are actually looking for a hotel operator. One of the buildings from the old hotel is still standing, and they're looking for an operator there. And if they don't find one, what it looks like they probably will do is tear that building down and continue to look for a hotel operator who might build a new building.
Stacey Vogel Davis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stacey Vogel Davis is associate editor at the Business Journal of Milwaukee. She reported recently on trends in air traffic at General Mitchell International Airport and the possibility that international carriers could potentially look to Milwaukee to expand. Do you go with the flow? Our next guest has been studying flow, that almost perfectly balanced place we sometimes get into when everything seems to work pretty effortlessly. We'll hear about the latest flow research next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. People in all walks of life experience it. That feeling when you're so engrossed in something that everything else seems to melt away. You're not aware of time passing, and you're only vaguely aware of your surroundings. It's a phenomenon often referred to as flow, and it's been studied for some time. But only comparatively recently have researchers begun to understand what's really happening in the bodies of people in the state of flow. Stephen Kotler looked closely at flow through the lens of extreme athletes, people like big wave surfers and base jumpers. Kotler is a UW-Madison graduate, co-founder of the Flow Genome Project, and the author of the new book, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. And Kotler says the research into flow has implications that go well beyond adventure sports. Kotler joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich on the line from New Mexico and offered a working definition.
Flow refers to an optimal state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. And most people have some experience with this state. Flow refers to those moments of total absorption where our focus becomes so intense that everything else falls away. Action awareness start to merge, sense of self, self-consciousness disappear. Time dilates, so sometimes it slows down. You get that freeze frame effect as if you've been in a car crash. Or it speeds up and 5 hours will pass by in 5 minutes. And throughout, all aspects of performance, mental and physical, go through the roof.
And you use sort of adventure sports as a focus for this book, but flow, as you imply, can take place in many different things that we're doing.
Absolutely. There are zillions of different on-ramps into flow, and I focused on the adventure sport athletes because they have gotten better at hacking the state of flow for some reasons that we can get into if you want than anybody else probably in the history of the world. So we can use them as case studies and apply this information across all domains in society. But we know flow is fundamental everywhere. For example, McKinsey just did a 10-year study. They found top executives are 5 times more productive in flow than out of flow.
Flow is something that's been known about for a long time, but has our understanding of flow always been grounded in science?
Well, our contemporary understanding of flow, the research on flow actually goes back about 150 years, and some of the kind of foundational work that was done in fields like cognitive neuroscience or experimental psychology were actually done on flow. William James talked about flow. We had different terminology. Abraham Maslow talked about flow. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi in the 70s actually gave the state its name. But what has happened since then and what's so amazing is there's been a revolution in neuroscience. So for the very first time in 150 years, in the past 15 years, and really in the past 5, we have been able to look under the hood. And we now understand the neurobiology of what's creating this experience, which is fantastic because if we understand what's creating it, we now know how to get more of it.
What have the technological developments been that have allowed us to get under the hood, if you will?
Well, 3 different areas, right? If you're talking about the neuroscience of anything, you want to know 3 things. You want to know neuroanatomy, which is where something in the brain is taking place, and fMRI has given us a look into that. You want to understand neuroelectricity and neurochemistry, which are the 2 ways the brain talks to itself. Neuroelectricity, that's EEG work. Now, that's been around for a very long time. Used to be that you had to sit absolutely still and not move and not blink and not yawn to get an accurate EEG reading. Our algorithms have just gotten so good that we've been able to filter out this noise so we can now have people moving around and figure out what their brain is doing. So it's given us a much deeper window to the brain. And the last bit is neurochemistry. And that's really a measuring problem. And we haven't been able to measure neurochemicals in the brain, not even in the body very well, until really the last 10 to 15 years.
How is flow manifesting itself in someone like an adventure athlete, whether it's a big wave surfer or an aerial skier or someone who's doing the kinds of mountaineering that seemed impossible once?
What you have to understand is how flow amplifies performance. And it does it in a lot of different ways. We just kind of covered some of the neuroscience behind it. But let's just start with the neurochemistry for a second. We now know that flow is a cocktail of kind of 5 of the most potent neurochemicals the brain can produce. Dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, andamine, and endorphins. Dopamine and norepinephrine are focusing chemicals. They help drive attention into the now. They help us take in more information per second and process more deeply. They also speed up muscle reaction times in various ways. And most importantly, they lower signal-to-noise ratios in the brain, which is a fancy way of saying they up our pattern recognition abilities. Pattern recognition is a really kind of fundamental property of the brain. It's the ability to link ideas together. So fundamental, all forms of creativity, critical thinking, any kinds of high-speed decision-making, you're going to want really fast pattern recognition. Anandamide does something else. It kills pain a little bit, but it also expands the database searched by the pattern recognition system to heighten creativity, which happens in flow all the time. The reason creativity goes through the roof is because not only do you have this upping of pattern recognition, our ability to link ideas together, but anandamide allows us to move beyond kind of the logical and the linear, and that's where you're getting creative breakthroughs.
Well, and one of the things that was interesting to read about was the parts of the brain that are acting most when this kind of pattern recognition is going on. It's almost reversed from what we might have intuited before. The parts of the brain that we might have thought would be quiet are active and vice versa.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. You know, it's a mistaken assumption, but they call it the 10% brain myth, this idea that we only use 10% of our brain. And there was a downstream corollary from that, which is that optimal performance must be us using 100% of our brain at all times. And this idea actually was a misquote of William James, but it came from Dale Carnegie. But it kind of became this mainstay of the self-help movement. Turns out it's entirely backwards. Flow is caused by what's called transient hypofrontality. Transient hypofrontality means the temporary deactivation of the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that houses most of our higher cognitive function. This is the part kind of right behind your forehead. In flow, major portions of the prefrontal cortex are shutting down. So, for example, why does time pass so strangely in flow? Time is actually calculated all over the prefrontal cortex. Parts of it start to wink out. You can no longer separate past from present from future. Another thing that happens is a portion of our brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. That's impulse control and self-monitoring. Self-monitoring is your inner critic, that kind of nagging, defeatist voice that's always in your head. It shuts up in flow. It goes away. Most of our higher cognitive functions are being traded out for the faster and more efficient subconscious processing.
If that's what's going on in the brain of someone who is experiencing flow, what do we know about how athletes are able to put themselves into a position where they can tap into flow?
What we now know is there are 17 different flow triggers. These are preconditions that lead to more flow. What action adventure sport athletes have done is they have literally built their lives around these triggers. Now, a lot of these triggers are very kind of fundamental in action adventure sports. A lot of them have nothing to do with action adventure sports, but they show up there. So to give you a couple of examples, there are 3 environmental triggers, 3 psychological triggers, 10 social triggers, and 1 creative trigger. Let's just talk about the psychological triggers. One of the simplest ones is actually known as clear goals. So the idea here is flow follows focus. So all of these triggers, every one of them, are ways of driving attention into the now. So when we set clear goals, we always know what we're doing, and we always know what to do next. So we don't have to wonder. We don't have to pull our attention out of the moment. We can stay focused where we are and thus have an easier time accessing flow. Another one of the psychological triggers is immediate feedback. When there's no gap between cause and effect, we know what to do next. So action adventure sports sort of happens automatically. If you're skiing a big couloir and you don't set your edge properly, you're going to end up on a face-first slide to the bottom. It's immediate feedback. We see this in business environments. For example, in medicine, surgeons turn out to be the only class of doctors that get better the longer they are out of medical school. Everybody else, their skills decline. Why is this? Surgeons get immediate feedback. They screw up, the patient dies on the table. It's immediate feedback. Radiologists, they may read a radiological screen, pass it on to the next guy, next gal, and they won't know about the outcome for 6 months, if at all. So there's a big gap between cause and effect. When feedback is immediate, again, it keeps attention focused in the now. This goes on and on. There are 17 of these various triggers. Action adventure sport athletes have built their lives around them. But anybody, pretty much anybody, can do the same.
Is it oversimplifying things to say that these are the kinds of decisions that if you stop to think about them, you're already lost?
Well, in flow, that is what happens. Why do we call the experience flow? It's because every decision, every action leads seamlessly, fluidly to the next. Flow is as close to picture-perfect decision-making as we can get. So this isn't to say that you can't stop and think about things in flow, but you can pull yourself out of the state fairly quickly that way.
You write that these athletes aren't adrenaline junkies. In fact, there may be the opposite. So what is the explanation for the rush that's also involved while they're in this state of flow?
First of all, you have to understand it contextually. For it to be flowy, for you to be able to go from one idea to the next, to the next, to the next, to get that very rapid decision-making, you can't get hung up. You need as many options as possible when making decisions. So flow is a choices wide open thing. The fight or flight response, the adrenaline response, is the exact opposite. There are options narrowed to 3, fight, flight, or flee. You can do 3 things instead of anything's possible. So it is the exact opposite. What's happening differently is in the fight or flight response, we often say that athletes have to move through the fight or flight response to get into flow. It's because the front end of the flow state and the front end of the flight or flight response are very similar. You get a rising of cortisol, norepinephrine, adrenaline. These are stress hormones and focusing chemicals. And What happens in flow is they go to a certain level, and then there is a global release of nitric oxide that kind of floats these chemicals out of your system and replaces them with a bunch of other neurochemicals. That doesn't happen in the flight or flight response. You just get those front-end chemicals rising up so you can't switch over into the flow state.
I was amazed to read that many of these athletes, some of the base jumpers and some of the people who ski off cliffs, essentially, are actually kind of terrified of heights.
Yeah, it's not as uncommon as you think. You have to understand what people don't see. You see Laird Hamilton on a 100-foot wave or a 50-foot wave, and you think, oh my God, I could never do that. That's insane. But what you forget is that Laird Hamilton basically grew up in Hawaii. He was being rescued by lifeguards at Pipeline every 4 or 5 days when he was a little kid. The lifeguards got so pissed off, they told his father to lock him up while his father went surfing. But, you know, there were years of 3-foot waves, 4-foot waves, 5-foot waves, 6-foot waves, 7-foot waves, pushing up what we call the challenge skills ratio. This is another flow trigger. Flow shows up when the challenge slightly exceeds your skill level and when you're stretching but not snapping, basically. So that's sort of how you ride the fight or flight response into the flow state. But Laird slowly upped this challenge skills ratio day after day, week after week, month after month. We see a video of Laird on the Millennium Wave or something like that, and you know it looks like the most incredible thing you've ever seen, and you ask them about it, and it's another day at the office for them.
What do we still not know about flow that we need to learn next, do you think?
Oh, my God, the list is so long. So what we did in the 20th century is we got great at understanding the psychology of flow. We understand that a bunch of these triggers that are psychological, and we have described the state very well, and we've really analyzed it. We have just started to plumb the neurobiology of the state. A lot of these things, for example, I mentioned a bunch of neurochemicals, we're not exactly certain the order that cascade. We've got some research on this, not enough. The physiology of flow, what happens in the body, is pretty much a black hole at this point. But again, we have some inklings, but what really needs to happen is, and this is kind of the work that we're doing at the Flow Genome Project, which is the organization that I co-founded to kind of advance flow science. So we're trying to map the psychology onto the neurobiology, onto the physiology, so we can have basically a heat map of flow. We don't think there's going to be exact coordinates. Everybody's going to differ. But if we have this heat map, we should be able to figure out exactly what's the easiest way for everybody to get into flow and what's the fastest, most reliable way to do it.
Let's say you're not an adventure athlete and you're not even necessarily a business leader. What is the takeaway for the average person on this? How do you see flow impacting that kind of stuff that people do that on its face doesn't seem to have a big application for flow, but probably does?
One of the things we know about flow is the neurochemicals that show up in flow massively jack up the immune system, and they sort of reset the nervous system. So they kind of filter out these stress hormones and they really amplify the immune system. So there's a tremendous healing benefit to flow, first of all. But let's go back to your question and why should the average person care about it? And I always say it comes down to three things: motivation, creativity, and learning. These neurochemicals that show up in flow are the most addictive chemicals on earth. Of course, psychologists don't like to use the word addictive, so they call flow the source code of intrinsic motivation. It means that once something starts producing flow, we'll go extraordinarily far out of our ways to get more of it and more of it and more of it. But the difference between flow and other addictions, because flow requires challenge, skills, and learning, it is an addiction that leads us into the future rather than backwards. So who doesn't need more motivation?
Were you able to get yourself into a state of flow as you wrote a book about getting into the state of flow?
Sometimes. You have to really understand the kind of challenge skills balance and the kind of the gap between it and what's perfect for each person. When I started writing the book, my publisher got so excited, they took what was going to be a 14-month deadline and asked me to do it in 7 months. So the challenge level, right off, I was like a chapter and a half into the book. I had just gotten a good pace, and all of a sudden the challenge level went through the roof. You know, I will tell you, my book, A Small Furry Prayer, I literally wrote the entire book in a flow state in almost a 3-week sitting. There was a lot of writer's block that led up to that, but once it started coming out of me, you know, it literally, the whole book showed up in 3 weeks and turned it in.
Well, Stephen Kotler, it's a really fascinating read, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Kotler is the author of The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. He's a UW-Madison graduate and now lives in New Mexico, where he is co-founder of the Flow Genome Project and the Rancho de Chihuahua Dog Sanctuary. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. Flo has also been featured on our It's a Material World series on Lake Effect Weekend. You can find links to those segments on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, our wine contributors see some old familiar faces at this year's premier event in Napa Valley. We'll hear from Ray Pfister next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Every year, wine contributor Ray Pfister goes west for the wine industry's annual Premier Napa Valley. It's a gathering of wine makers, distributors, and other insiders in order to introduce new vintages and to raise money for charity. Pfister has just returned from reporting on this whirlwind week of wine where he interviewed the industry's biggest names. And some of those names will be familiar to Milwaukee listeners. Pfister joined Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce to recap the highlights from this year's event.
Really, the big thing this year was that every winemaker, just about every winemaker, was offering the 2012 vintage, which is, of course, the highly anticipated, you know, vintage of the decade, vintage of the century. And it didn't disappoint because the auction as a whole doubled what it did last year. I believe it was 2.6 million last year. Don't quote me on that. But this year, you can quote me, it was $5.9 million. The highest lot Scarecrow Wines went for, $260,000.
Why were people anticipating the 2012 vintage so much? What's the story behind that?
It was the perfect growing season. I had a number of winemakers say to me they really could have taken a vacation. The wine would have made itself. And you don't hear winemakers say that very often. So the weather was perfect.
Especially not in the last year where they were experiencing such a bad drought.
Right. 11 was a tough season because there was a lot of rain, especially during harvest. A lot of people had to harvest late. 12 was perfect. 13 was hot, but just a great growing season again. And 14, everybody knows California has been suffering a drought. Napa Valley is not exempt from that. Although just after we left, one of the things I told many of my friends is I wish you, the moment I step on the plane, nothing but rain for weeks. And oddly enough, they got quite a bit of rain afterwards. But the state still needs it in general. People forget that California is a huge agricultural state.
So what were people saying about the 2012 vintage at Premier? What were some of the responses people were getting?
Approachable, tasty. I think the numbers spoke for themselves, that to literally see it double. You know, and to keep in mind, too, that the Premier event is for the trade only, so it's distributors, retailers, us media that are lucky enough to be invited, and just an overall reaction of this was an amazing vintage.
Were there tastings? Did you get to try any of it?
Oh, yeah. Well, the barrel tasting is all about that. You know, you have about 220-some lots, and the winemakers are there, and you can go taste these lots. The shame of the whole thing is you don't really get to sit and enjoy it. We're working. We cut about 41 interviews just during the barrel tasting itself, which is about, I guess, about 3 hours, give or take. One of the interesting responses was talking to Jean Fierre, who is the winemaker for Alpha Omega. I know he would probably laugh at me for the way I pronounced his name. But Jean turned the tables on me and asked me what I was seeing from everybody, kind of like you're asking me. And again, it's all about 2012 and his preference for what he thinks of 2013 was. But this is coming from the horse's mouth. You know, the winemaker himself, this is the guy who's been in the trenches with the grapes, and especially Jean, because he spends a lot of time babysitting his grapes.
Most people say 13 is wonderful. It's an outstanding year. Was it a great vintage? No doubt. Because we were never put in a situation of a threat of rain or anything like that. But it was an extreme vintage with extreme heat. So the people that didn't have the luxury of actually harvesting raisin vineyard and multiple picks will have wines that I think sometimes will not be up to their expectation. And I think the beauty of 12 is a little bit colder vintage compared to 13, therefore much more acidity to balance out the fruit, and it gives a little bit more freshness to the aromatic profile of the wine.
Ray, whenever you go to Premier, you always get to meet these amazing winemakers, people who are really at the top of their game, who are shaping the industry that we get to enjoy as wine lovers. One of the people you got to meet this year was Aaron Pott, who is really one of the country's top winemakers, young too, who it seems like everybody wants to get their hands on him.
Yeah, he does consulting and he makes wine and he makes his own wine as well as working for other wineries. He's one of the top guys, certainly one of the most talked about guys. I've been wanting to meet him for years.
All of our wines are very handcrafted and it's what we devote our life to. So the representation of all we love.
Well, and I would say maybe double in your case because you're involved in so many projects. I mean, you are a very busy man.
Yeah, incredibly busy. My wife doesn't even recognize me anymore.
Humor. And I like that he has the passion for wine, but he doesn't take it so seriously. If our listeners check out our Facebook page, you can see him in this hilariously bright red jacket that he bought, I think, at a secondhand store. A very approachable and really pleasant guy to talk to. I actually bought one of his wines. It's called Chester's Anvil. And how could you not buy a wine with that kind of label?
And Chester's Anvil comes out of his personal label, Aaron Pott Wine.
Right, right. But he does work, obviously, as I said, for a number of winemakers. One of my favorites is Blackbird. Specifically, Blackbird is a Merlot. And, you know, a lot of people still get this thing from sideways. Merlot's not so great. And they don't realize that in France, Petrus is made from Merlot. This is about a $4,000 bottle of wine. So don't underestimate it.
Well, speaking of wines that maybe don't always get the respect that they deserve, Zinfandel is one, I'm thinking, especially because of white Zinfandel. But you've met some people who maybe would beg to differ.
Well, yeah. You know, the thing about Zinfandel, it's a great wine. It's a wonderful wine, and it's just like anything else. You just need to educate yourself. And my favorite education is drinking it. How can you deny that? And, you know, truth be told, a lot of us started with white Zinfandel. I'm not afraid to admit 20 years ago, that's what I drank. If it weren't for that, I might have never gone down this path. But in the case of Zinfandel, the Robert Bialy Winery in Napa met Robert for the first time, have wanted to meet him for years. And what a great guy. Got a great story. Got this sign on the property that says, watch out for the black chicken. Maybe we'll hear about that as we go. But he makes 14 or 16, I forget which, different Zins. This is a guy who's very focused. And, man, I've always been impressed by his wines. And those you can find around here.
And again, black chicken is actually a code word for Zinfandel, as we're going to hear Robert Bialy explain.
And my dad, at a young age, he was 14 years old, and he started learning how to make wine. He kind of figured out that, you know, that he could make just a little bit more if he was to turn this product, grape, into the end result, into wine, and sell it to his old friends. So he's selling bootleg Zinfandel kind of under the table over a party line. It's a public line, you know, like when you pick up the phone. I remember, of course. Okay, in the country, that's what it was. You pick up the phone and other people are listening. So he developed this code word, and in Italian, he would only sell to the Italians. There we go. Hey, Aldo, I need 3 dozen eggs and a black chicken, gallina nera. Code word for a jug of Zin. You know, I can't make a story up like that, you know? And then he'd deliver it free on a Friday night in the old Studebaker. And we still have that car. It was his first car. So when my mom first arrived, my dad went back to Italy, married her, brought her back. And she was here 1 week, and she had no idea that what was really going on, except that there was lots of chickens out in the yard and whatnot. She was still really clueless. Anyway, this Giovanni called, and in Italian, you know, he's talking to my mother. Welcome to California. You know, welcome to Napa, Clementina. We've heard all about you and love to meet you someday. But in the meantime, you know, tell Aldo, you know, I need 3 dozen eggs and a gallina nera. And she goes, huh. You know, Giovanni, I'm almost positive Christina, you know, Aldo's mother, I think Christina only has white chickens. You tell Aldo that I need a gallina nera. And he kind of like puts the phone down. She had no idea she married into a bootlegging family.
Prohibition days, you know, you had to have your own language. I love the idea of saying, give me some black chicken, you know.
Wonder what would happen if you did that in a restaurant.
You might get Zinfandel.
Now, in contrast to Merlot or Zinfandel, who, again, maybe get their reputation slandered unfairly, you have blends, and you actually learned about a great new blend.
Yeah, well, this was a blend made specifically for Premier, which is what really all the wines made for Premier are made for that event. They're one of a kind. They're very special. People might keep them for their personal collections. Some of the distributors can sell them with a private label on them. But we met up with Laura Long, daughter of David Arthur, David Arthur Wines, which is a winery I've been a fan of for a long time. And her dad, along with a couple of partners, made a wine called Tres Locos.
And here she explains why it's called that.
It's called Tres Locos, lot number 190, and that's a blend of three appellations, three wineries, all 100% Cabernet. You have David Arthur, of course, Constant up on Diamond Mountain, and then Reynolds family over in Stag's Leap.
It's kind of a little bit of everywhere, which is cool.
It is, and it's called Tres Locos. If you know the guys, you know they are a little loco.
You'll have some nutballs doing this now.
You also got to meet up with one of your good friends who you've spoken to several times now on Life Between the Vines, Amy Aiken.
Yeah, Amy is a former Wisconsinite. She moved out to California a long time ago, I think, when she realized the weather here wasn't her cup of tea. And she makes a phenomenal wine called Meander. She's married to Joel Aiken, and Joel makes his own wine, which is called Aiken. Amy's a great winemaker. She knows what she likes, and she also has a great palate. And that's what it is. It's making wine for people who want to be able to enjoy their wine and not have to sit back and judge it or give it points or anything like that. And one of the things I had mentioned to her is I just cracked one of her 2005 Meanders about 2 weeks before we went out there. And I said, wow, it was aging stunningly. It was beautiful. And it's one of the fun things about keeping a cellar is when you go into it and you look at a wine that's an 01, and I remember, gosh, I bought that 11 years ago, and I just try to forget about it. I look forward to that day when I can crack it. And she talks about it's about you, not about what somebody tells you it should be.
Well, I think there's something to this idea of buying three bottles, trying one, and then letting the others sit. And it's kind of funny when you come back to them, all of a sudden you've got a wine that's 10 years old.
Yes, that's very true. And you also see the progression of a wine as it bottle ages. You know, when it's brand new, it might be a little more fruit forward and tannin forward. As it ages, those tannins soften and the fruits kind of take the back seat to a really beautiful texture and a nice long finish. So it's all in how you like it. You know, if it's young, it's not wrong. And if it's old, it's not wrong. It's what you like.
Well, again, that was Amy Aiken, former Wisconsinite, now lives out in Napa Valley making wine. But speaking of Wisconsin, you met up with another Wisconsinite who'd be pretty familiar to our Milwaukee listeners.
Yeah, and I should put in a plug also for Barry Marshall, who is another former Wisconsinite who I met for the very first time, a winemaker in California. And Barry took the time and the pain to seek out his good friend. Barry introduced us to Mike Amasich, better known as the Pizza Man. And what a pleasure it was to meet this guy, because he's a total character. On the side, when we're traveling around the valley going to all these different events before the main event, I saw Mike get out of this souped-up, V8 Mustang he's driving around. And, he's not a young guy, and he's tooling around in this car having a good old time. It was great.
You just used the word overwhelming. I mean, this is quite a week for somebody like you who's a wine lover.
I wish this was almost filmed and documented so the average person that's not here could see all this. We are very fortunate being in the trade to get invited to an event like this.
Yeah, very fortunate indeed. And so Pizza Man is a very, very well-known restaurant in Milwaukee, specifically known for a monster wine selection. The original restaurant burned down a few years ago, but how long was the original restaurant in business?
The original restaurant was in business for 40 years, and we carried over 600 wines by the glass.
By the glass.
By the glass. And the new one, which has been open now for about 9 months, we got our cellar up to about 300. I'm out here looking for little itty-bitty wineries that you just can't find in your normal retailer or liquor store.
That's the best thing about coming here. Mike, this has been a real pleasure meeting you this week and a lot of fun hanging out with you. I appreciate that.
I encourage your listeners to come on the 15th of every month.
What's happening on the 15th?
I have a car payment, and it's very... it helps me out a little.
We'll make sure we promote that. Thanks very much.
I'm just kidding.
Well, Ray, sum up Premier 2014 for us.
Well, I don't use this word very often, but I'd say awesome. It was just a really great week. Left there feeling satisfied and not wanting to leave there.
Well, Ray Pfister, we're glad to have you back here in Milwaukee and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks very much.
Our wine contributor, Ray Pfister, runs the wine blog and podcast Life Between the Vines, where you can hear more of his interviews from Premier. Pfister also owns Fifth Floor Recording in Milwaukee's Third Ward, and he spoke with Stephanie Lecce. We'll take one last break and then take a tour of the Racine Art Museum and its collection of world-class ceramics. Lake Effect returns with Bruce Pepich right after this. Back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee is hosting the annual conference of the National Council on Education for the Ceramic Arts this week, and more than 5,000 ceramic artists are in town to participate. Local galleries and museums are presenting exhibits that feature the wide world of modern-day ceramic art, and there are some that are farther afield as well, including an exhibit at the Racine Art Museum. RAM's specialty is the world of craft, and more than 50% of its collection is ceramics of all kinds, both functional and sculptural. I took a road trip to RAM ahead of the conference to speak with Bruce Pepich, the museum's executive director and curator of collections. If you haven't been to RAM, it's right on Main Street in downtown Racine. You walk in from the sidewalk. Pepich met me on the first floor to begin our tour.
RAM, which opened up in 2003, is actually a renovation of two old buildings, two mercantile structures that date back to the 1870s. One of the two buildings was a department store, and the other was a bank, and the bank was robbed by John Dillinger in a daring daylight holdup in the 1930s, which is a big part of our local history. And it's been wonderful for us to sort of reimagine those two structures as a contemporary art museum that's wrapped in acrylic and lighted at night, and it becomes a beacon for culture in the downtown of Racine.
We're standing in the old department store now. I can't even see a department store. You've done a beautiful job in kind of creating a museum space out of it.
What I like about this space the most is it has a sense of light that's very zen-like, very Asian, and the light changes throughout the day as the sun passes over the building. And the architects, Brennan Stuhl and Lynch, are out of Chicago, and they had great, great sensitivity for the scale of the work that we own in the collection. With the craft collection, many of the objects are things that people held or used, pots, wall hangings, handmade jewelry that they wore, and so forth. So there's a lot of smaller scale work, and the building does have a sense of grandness set about it, but it doesn't overwhelm these objects. It's very much in keeping with them. There's a sense of spirituality that the work is very much in contact with the public when they come in. You can get close. There's a sense of, almost a respect that exists for the viewer and the object that comes out of the building. There's just a wonderful aura that you feel when you come in. At least I've always felt this, and our guests constantly comment on it to us.
It's very comfortable and intimate at the same time as being spacious and light.
And not off-putting. You don't feel like, well, why do you dare come in here? It's the exact opposite.
We're standing down in the ground floor exhibit area. How many exhibit halls do you have in total?
We have three main galleries, and the largest of the three galleries is on the second floor. And one gallery on the main floor is very open to the outside, so we tend to show ceramics, glass, and metal objects in that space because they're less sensitive to light. And of course, with all the windows, even with them being filmed and so forth, there is still a great deal of light exposure coming in.
Yeah, the UV problem.
But you know, we have an 8,000 piece collection, and half of that collection is in craft media, so that's ceramics and fibers and glass, metal, wood, and polymer. And of half those pieces, the largest proportion is ceramic. It's almost half of that half. So there's always something new in the collection to bring out in this space. And then there's a darker space adjacent to it that's about the same size, and we can show works on paper, we can show fibers, we can show handmade books, photography, and so forth, baskets and fiber wall hangings in here. And so you can get an exposure to a variety of media all on the first floor. The second floor space is easier to control from the standpoint of light. So in that space, we go ahead and we can do anything we want.
Up there.
Yes.
Okay.
Anything the traffic will allow.
All right. Well, shall we go up?
Sure. Let's do that. For this room, we actually took the second and the third floors of one of the two buildings and broke through the floor to give us an 18-foot-high ceiling in the majority of the space. We can have larger-scale pieces on exhibit and have a sense of breathing space overhead.
What is on exhibit right now?
The pieces on exhibit in this space right now are highlights from the museum's ceramics collection. And as I said, it's the largest portion of the craft collection in the museum's holdings, and these are works that I have brought into the museum as curator of collections, but that Lena Vigna, our exhibition curator, has selected from our holdings to put on display. And what I think is most interesting about this is that we chose a number of large-scale pieces, bigger than most guests I would think would imagine could be an object you could create out of clay, and then also functional ceramics and smaller scale pieces. We have bowls and some teapots. That's one of the things we're known for. We have a very, very large teapot collection of about 600 teapots. We had a woman in St. Louis, a collector in St. Louis named Donna Moog, around the year 2000, gave us almost 300 teapots. And we have had other collectors had been giving us teapots prior to that and since then as well. So we've really built one of the main teapot collections in the country. But when I say teapots, it's not your grandmother's teapot. There are functional works, there are sculptural works, and there are things in between.
We're standing at one end, and we're looking down, and the teapots that have been selected are on display about 40 feet away?
Mm-hmm, about 40 feet
away. Yeah. And I can see that there are some, even from this distance, where you think there's no tea coming out of that.
There's one that I like a great deal. It is a little bit larger than life-sized, a hand holding a seashell, and it is covered with drawings of being by the water's edge, and it actually is a teapot. Most of these pieces do have a lid, a spout, and a handle, but it does take some looking to find that in some of the instances, and that is intentional on the part of the artist. And you'd say to me, why teapots? Well, I think many ceramics programs require the student to be able to throw and build a teapot because you use so many different technical approaches. I mean, you have to throw in general, you throw the body on the wheel, you have to form the handle, you have to make the lid and make sure the lid fits, you have to make a spout, so you're making different kinds of shapes and using different kinds of construction methods, and it's all in one piece. And in the 1980s and 1990s, particularly in America, the teapot just became this forum in which many clay artists delved and plowed their own ideas into this structure to see how different they could make it and still keep it sort of recognizable as a teapot. How much personality could they put in these objects? And the artists would talk to each other in the works they were creating. And we have a lot of that captured here in sort of physical snapshots in the works that are in the collection.
I love the idea of something so mundane as a teapot, something just most people think of as functional, being that vehicle through which they're expressing all this creativity and thought about what art is.
Well, you know, we have many different audiences, and our field of guests here tends to be very, very broad, both from throughout the region and from the standpoint of their knowledge and their background and exposure to art. And the wonderful thing is that everyone who comes in this door, no matter what their social status, their economic status, etc., is, everyone has a memory from their family life of a teapot. A mother had one, a grandmother had one, an aunt had one, and when you got together with that family member and the teapot came out, it was a special occasion. You had tea and cookies with grandmother. You visited with an aunt. There was something very convivial and very emotional attached to these objects, and you can see all of this just sort of tumbling out of people's memories and their experiences as they start to respond to the work when they look at it. It's really quite fascinating. Plus, the form, no matter how abstract the object gets, the form opens a doorway for the viewer, and they say, all right, where's the lid? Where's the spout? Where's the handle? And they become engaged with the work, which they might not be so engaged if they saw it as an abstract sculpture on a pedestal.
Do you find that once people engage with the teapots, that they're more open to other kinds of sculptural ceramics that you have here that they might have walked by before they saw the teapots?
Yes. You know what I find it is, no matter how abstract or challenging the concept is in the work we show here, the fact that many of the guests have had family members who have quilted or crocheted or have painted china or have maybe whittled wooden toys for family members, they all understand at least rudimentary aspects of the handworking techniques that are employed, and there is a respect for that. There's a respect for what the artist had to master prior to being able to get his or her ideas formulated and out. So no one ever walks into the museum and says, my four-year-old could do that, because it doesn't look slapdash. They know a lot goes into the creation of the object.
And I would imagine, again, that knowledge helps them approach something that they might find off-putting otherwise.
I think, you know, there's been this sort of misapprehension on the part of the public about contemporary art, in the sense that no matter how much the public is able to understand, that the artists still keep going further and further out ahead of them. And there is, I think, a sense of discomfort among the populace about that, because there is this sense of, well, are we being left out, or is someone playing a joke on us? And that type of mindset never occurs when people come here, because they're immediately ushered into the discussion by the artist. There's a tactile quality about the pieces, or a sense of pattern, or the way the object relates to function in some cases, or the way it doesn't relate to function but is in a form that was once functional, but is maybe larger in scale, or a teapot that wouldn't hold water because it has holes in it, but it still has the shape of a teapot. Those kinds of things, I think, help prepare viewers, regardless of the amount of knowledge they have about art, and it makes it a more even exchange between the artist speaking through the object to the viewer and the viewer listening to the artist and then communicating back by the way they respond to the work. It is a conversation that takes place. The object is the fulcrum for that conversation.
Well, with that, Bruce, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today and to take me around a little bit of the collection here at RAM. I really appreciate it.
So delighted to have you with us, Bonnie. Thanks for coming.
Bruce Pepich is the executive director and curator of collections at the Racine Art Museum. You can hear the rest of our tour through the museum's current exhibits, including more teapots, on our website. There are photos there as well. The National Council on Education for the Ceramic Arts is holding its annual conference in Milwaukee this week, with many area galleries and museums participating, including Racine. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel offered some gallery suggestions, and we have a link to it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect, from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.